You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hello, podcast fans, and welcome back to a very special new episode of the Hit Podcast. It's an interview that we're going to be doing. You will have seen we've done some on our Star Trek channel before. We are going to be interviewing somewhat of a geek legend, Patricia Tallman. Patricia is perhaps best known for her work in the 1990 cult classic Night of the Living Dead as Barbara, the beleaguered heroine. Some may argue she's best known for her role as Lita Alexander in the award-winning series Babylon 5. Either way, she's been swept into a career that features horror and sci-fi projects. She's less recognizable, but no less memorable, as the horror hag in Army of Darkness, the third Evil Dead film. Theater being a true love, Pat was delighted to be featured in the Los Angeles Sci-Fest of plays. Fans make a game of spotting her in the over 50 appearances in the Star Trek franchise across Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, and the feature film Generations. Zombie fans will enjoy Dead Air, and sci-fi fans may enjoy Pat's book Pleasure Thresholds, Patricia Tallman's Babylon 5 memoirs, which is currently in its second printing. Her recent work is helping people release their inner badass by leading epic quests to live their dreams of adventure and creativity in Patricia Tallman's Magical Living, which I'm sure she'll tell us all about. Pat's other projects include starring in the sci-fi audio thriller series Anne Manx, playing the evil badass Lieutenant Jean Richmond. Her favourite role is that of mother to her son, Julian. Equally important to Patricia is her fundraising activities for the Children of Penny Lane. Through her efforts with the sci-fi and horror community, Pat and her fans have contributed more than $350,000 over the past several years. Since 1996, Pat, her friends, family, and fans have made a holiday happen for the Penny Lane kids through the Be a Santa program. You can go to beasanta.org to join in the fun. We will, of course, link that in the description. And fans can connect with Pat on her blog, which is at questretreats.com, on her Facebook page, facebook.com/PatriciaTallmanpage, capital P, T, and P, at Quest Retreats for Nerds, or at PatriciaTallman.rocks on Instagram, or on Twitter at Patricia Tallman. All the links are in her Koji page, which we will again link in the description to this video. So yeah, very excited to be talking to Patricia. We're both huge fans of her film work and her work on our favorite nerd franchises, Star Trek and Babylon 5 and the like. So yeah. DK, anything you're particularly looking forward to asking her about?
Her movie work. I love Night of the Living Dead. B5, if we can manage to fit in. But pretty much anything. She's bringing everything.
Absolutely. I'm going to hope she maybe chats with us a little bit about Star Trek being a Trekkie nerd. But obviously, Jurassic Park for me. If we can get her to talk a little bit about experience on that film, it means a little bit of importance to me. So yeah, without further ado, we're going to cross over to ourselves, and we'll be hopefully here chatting with Patricia Tallman.
Okay, so we'll dive right in. You began at a very early age appearing with your father on his radio show. Is that right?
That's very true.
Is that what inspired you to become an actor?
No, I didn't. I was 2 years old. Kids are so, what's the word? Uninhibited. You know, there's no filter with children, which is which is why they're so fun. I don't remember it at all, but maybe there was something in there that it was, this is this is what I'm going to do. I have no idea. Isn't that amazing, though? I mean, you think about that as kids. I love the idea of when you think about what you really, really loved when you were tiny and you had no inhibitions and you just were just loving whatever it was fully, yeah, all out. When you think about that later in life, it's usually still something you enjoy, even in your 60s or your 70s. You know, you still love those things, whether it was, yeah, you know, creating a thing or, yeah. So maybe I was, you know, always to be a performer. I have no idea.
Inspired. You just knew that you loved it at the time.
Yeah, I did.
That's cool. Well, a lot of your early acting career, I noticed, was in musicals and musical theatre. Is that a genre that you're especially drawn to? And do you have a favourite musical, if so?
Oh, wow. Yeah, I was really drawn to it. I love dancing. And I was never an amazing singer, but I could sing. I could hold a tune. I could learn a part. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I did Bye Bye Birdie. I was the lead in that. There was some amazing times in musical theater. I ended up working off Broadway in musical theater. I did a lot of shows in high school and college. I started working professionally when I was 15. So all through my career, I was always somehow involved in a musical theater program. And I always loved it. There's something about telling stories with the heightened reality, whether it's stage combat or science fiction or fantasy like Lord of the Rings or even musical theater, honestly, that it's all related in that it's a heightened reality using different elements to give a different experience so that humans get to be transported out of the mundane and the regular, and you go off into these fantasy worlds, which are really just a hyper extension of our own. So it's a really interesting way to tell stories.
Awesome.
Fantastic.
do you recall what it was that led you into stunt work? Was it just that was the only way into these sort of heightened genres?
Right. No, I always enjoyed sword fighting. So for me, it was action adventure. Doing anything that was hyper adventurous was attractive to me. And then the romance of period sword technique, just to me, I loved it. I always loved it. I watched Basil Rathbone as Errol Flynn when I was a kid. You know, I loved those black and white movies, and, you know, I just always really loved it, the sword fighting thing. And there was also, you know, the bad guy, like Basil Rathbone was always the bad guy. And he seemed to be having so much fun. Being so evil and so good with weapons, you know, so I started taking in New York City, because I'm a huge nerd, I would take dance classes and period sword technique classes because I just loved it. And I met people in those classes who were stunt people. And that's when I first became aware of stunts as being an actual career. I had no idea. I mean, back then in the 80s and the 90s, who knew about stunts? We really didn't pay attention to it then. Not as an actual job. You know, it might be a fun fact behind the scenes or something, but you never really thought about it. And then, you know, so for me in 1980, I did Knight Riders and I met a bunch of stunt people, but they were doing things that I wouldn't do, like motorcycle riding, that I had no interest in. But then the sword work I was interested in before I even got to college. Cool. So, yeah, so I would say that would be my gateway drug. It was a weaponry, edged weapons in particular, that got me interested into stunts.
That's fair enough.
It's a note to the audience out there. Never mess with Pat Talman.
Yeah, exactly.
I was just going to say
Basil Rathbone might be sort of the evil villain to you guys. He'll always be Sherlock Holmes to us here in the UK.
He was an amazing Sherlock Holmes. He was like my favorite. Although I love Jeremy Brett too. He was amazing too, wasn't he?
Oh, yes. Definitely.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Awesome.
So good. So good. I am a huge Holmes fan, by the way.
Oh yeah, me too. Oh, well, we could be here all day. But that's fair enough.
We could be here all day.
That's fair enough. Yeah. We're gonna talk about it a little bit later, but your newest workshop at time of recording is all about conquering what you call our fear dragon. And as an actress, that's right, and especially as a stunt performer, you must have had situations where that fear dragon came up. Do you recall anything in particular that was a key moment, and how did you conquer it at the time?
Oh, interesting question. Yeah, the I call it the fear dragon. It's really the amygdala and how it affects our body. You know, I didn't know any of that back in when I was working as a stunt woman.
Yeah.
I would just push through it as we all do, you know, but it takes a toll if you don't really understand how to work with it. It takes a toll on you after a while. And especially if you're in a profession that requires you to face your fears on a regular basis.
Yeah, exactly.
Or you're just stressed out all the time. There's a reason. I mean, stress and fear are best buddies. You know, they're completely related. So they're all the same mechanism in there. Now, so learning how to cope with it became really important to me. But I liked your question. So let's see. Anything having to do with heights, as far as big fear for me, that I hated heights. I never felt like I could be in control in heights. My body wasn't playing nice. I couldn't go on a stepladder without feeling, you know, queasy and not like I can't quite balance. Something terrible is going to happen. I have no idea why that is, but it, you know, we all have different things that we don't, that we have uncontrollable fear around. And that heights was that for me. And wouldn't you know that most of my work as a stunt woman would involve some kind of fucking heights? You know, do you mind standing on the edge of this building, or we're going to have you fall off this cliff into some water, or, you know, it's one thing after another. Are you kidding me? It's like Indiana Jones. Snakes. Doesn't have to be snakes, you know. I'm not afraid of snakes, but I am afraid of heights. But I ended up doing it all the time. And the worst one, I think, was when I was doubling Gina Davis on a movie called Long Kiss Goodnight. And I talk about feeling helpless. I was on the end of a cable hanging over the side of a rock quarry where we shot all these scenes, which they would later paint in the visuals. I think it was supposed to be near Niagara Falls, but it was just a rock quarry. And I was hanging by, wearing a harness with the cable running through my wardrobe. I'm hanging upside down in the middle of the night off of a construction crane, one of those huge construction cranes that was perched on the edge of the rock quarry. And I'm hanging, so I was probably, you know, 70 or 80 feet over the quarry floor, and completely helpless, because if anything goes wrong, what am I going to do? You know, there's nothing I can do. And, you know, on action, they let you drop. You free fall for a while, and then the mechanism kicks in, and you know it's supposed to slow you down so that you don't then really smash into the ground, which is nice. So, you know, I'm fingers crossed. You know, it was just horrendous.
Oh, wow.
Horrendous. That probably took years off of my life. Yeah. So I would say those are the worst for me personally.
Oh, I share your fear of heights. Yeah. So, yeah, I can completely understand where you're coming from with that. You mentioned it earlier.
You don't feel like you have any control, right? I mean, you don't have any control. It's like your body's just going,
Yeah.
We're not doing this. And you're like, come on. I'm on an escalator. I know I'm safe. Everyone else is just fine. Look at the little kids. Come on. And your body's like, nope.
Yeah. Mine stretches. Mine stretches. Roller coaster. Mentioned it earlier, Knight Riders. I understand George Romero contacted you himself for the role. Is that right? And how did that come about?
Knight Riders. No, not for that. Night of the Living Dead, Tom Savini contacted me directly. For Knight Riders, I had been in school at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh, which was George's alma mater. He went to Carnegie Mellon as well, CMU. And we were, you know, in the drama department, and everybody knew about George Romero because he was a hometown boy, huge director at the time. And I just heard through the grapevine that he was doing this movie. I actually was already in New York City, and I auditioned for the film in New York, even though we went back to Pittsburgh to shoot it.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Yeah.
That way. But you're right. I mean, Tom Savini did contact me directly for Barbara in Night of the Living Dead. But they already had hired a casting director in New York, and I had moved to Los Angeles at that point. So I again had to audition and send in a tape. In those days, it was a VHS tape, you know, like this big. And Marty Schiff, my friend who's also in Knight Riders, shot it on this huge camera, you know, back in those days. Oh my God, I don't even know how I picked it up. But yeah, so I had to audition for it, even though Tom was like, oh, I want Patty Tom. And so luckily Tom was more powerful than the casting director.
That kind of brings me to the next question, really. You took your role as Barbara in Savini's remake of Night of the Living Dead. It's always been a personal favourite. I think it's quite an underrated movie. Romero original, it's considered a horror classic with Judith O'Day's depiction of Barbara iconic. Had you seen the original before you took the role? And if so, were you nervous of the footsteps?
Luckily, yeah, I saw the original while I was in school in Pittsburgh. It was like a rite of passage. Everyone had to see it at the midnight showing in downtown Squirrel Hill in Pittsburgh. And it was, you know, horrifying. I don't like horror movies. And that one is gut-wrenching, as you know, the original 1968 black and white. Oh, my gosh. So, you know, it's intense. And when Tom first said, hey, do you want to do, you know, he contacted me in 1989, I guess. We shot it in 1990. Do you want to do this? And I said, no. Why would I? No, I don't want to do that. And he said, you know, there was nothing in me that would have been able to do what Judy O'Day did so, so, so well, which was the original Barbara. You know, you go into, talk about Fear Dragon, you go into the four F's when you're frightened, when you're afraid, the fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. And she went into freeze, which was just catatonic, and then dies, you know, and that completely realistic. It was absolutely true and realistic. And also really true to form for that period in time when women weren't expected or even allowed, you know, to have any inch of badassery in them. So when Tommy was, well, do you want to, we're going to do a color remake. Do you want to do it? I was like, no, I don't want to perpetuate that. And it was already done perfectly. No, I don't want anything to do with it. And he said, no, read the script. And so then I read it and I saw how he had revamped Barbara and how it was completely different. And then yeah. I was, oh, okay, got it. Yeah, now that makes more sense for me and who I am. And in the 1990s at that point.
Yeah. You've preempted my next question, actually, which was regards to Barbara, because she was a bit of an ass kicker in your version. So I'm just wondering if that's what drew you to the script.
Yeah, absolutely. I love the stories where you've got a regular person, man or woman, doesn't matter, extraordinary circumstance comes in and they have to rise to the occasion or perish. You know, that's kind of, you just have to, they become the hero and they don't want to be, but they have to be in order to get through to the other side, or there's something that really inspires them as far as justice goes, you know, something like that. But for Barbara, it was just a matter of, you know, she had it in her somewhere, never had to have it activated before, but then gets to do that. So that really interested me. That was super interesting.
Yeah. This one.
So how many times a day do you hear they're coming to get you, Barbara?
I don't hear it every day. Thank God. I do get it fairly often though, when I'm out at horror conventions or, you know, doing something like this, and but I don't mind, you know, I don't mind at all. I think it's really an honor to have been a part of something that people loved so much.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. I think
it's strange you say that you're not really that big of a fan of horror, because you've worked with some real horror legends. And I would just like to know, as an actual kind of horror nerd myself, what it's like working with Ramiro Savini and even Wes Craven.
They're all, I mean, everybody. And I've met Stephen King and Sam Raimi, for example, you know. All of them really great people. Also, maybe they just purge their demons and their creativity and then they can be nice people. I have no idea. It's so funny too, because George and Stephen King both are really big people, tall, big, imposing, you know. Dark hair, sometimes has a beard, you know, they could be scary people, but they're so nice. Both George and Stephen were so nice to me. And George was one of the most, I think, beloved of all the directors I've worked with, as far as his crew and the actors who work with him. They just were totally devoted to him because he was so kind and empowering, and he was able to be very clear and say what he wants. No, that's not, you know what I think, it's a little, without ever pushing his weight around, you know what I mean. He always made you feel like you really did have a say in what's going on. And so I constantly say that I was so lucky in Knight Riders to have George as my first director, because I was fresh out of drama school and hadn't worked in front of a camera before. I'd only done theater work.
Yeah.
So to have him be my first director, I was just so blessed, because he was incredibly kind. And I didn't know I was putting my ideas out there for my character. I wouldn't do that for anybody else. I knew better than that. But I would definitely have ideas for my own character. And he pretty much embraced all of them, except for I did ask not to do the nude scene. I said, why do I have to have my shirt? You know, he's like, no, you got to do that. And I was like, okay, all right. But everything else, the ending scene in Knight Riders, that was all my idea for my character. I came up with the line, hey, haven't you taken some vows or something, that Julie Dean says to Friar Tuck? I mean, he was just really collaborative, and I know he made everybody feel amazing who worked with him. So Savini's like that too. He's very much a director. He's very much an actor's director, probably because he's an amazing actor himself. And he hires people he can trust. He says it makes his life so much easier. And I can see why that would be true. He just said, I know I can trust you. Just you, I know that you're going to do what I ask you to do, or you're going to, you know what the scene needs. I want to see what you've got. You know, I mean, he was the same way. And maybe that's because he was so close to George and it started his whole career with George. So that rubbed off on him. But he must have had that in him somewhere anyway. And Sam Raimi, very soft-spoken. very kind of shy, really. I mean, he didn't, and until he wanted to direct, that he turned into somebody else and would get on the, he was talking to us in Army of Darkness. And I was in the Army one, I was one of the stunt people. And he gets on this megaphone, you know, and he starts, all right, all you deadites, you scum, you filth of the earth. It was like, who is this guy? He's so shy. But now when he's got something to say.
That's awesome. That's fair enough. Yeah. Great. Well, speaking of sort of working with legendary directors, I did read that you worked as a stunt double for Laura Dern on one of my favorite movies, Jurassic Park. So what was it like on a Steven Spielberg set? And did you realize you were working on what would become probably the definitive blockbuster of our generation?
Wow. No, we certainly did not know we were making what Jurassic Park turned into. I mean, it was, those effects had never been seen before, right? Remember, you know, none of that had ever been seen before. Like, you know, we thought, okay, you know, we've got dinosaurs. Okay, whatever. Yeah. You didn't know they were going to be so badass, but you did know if it was a Spielberg film, it had a chance to be pretty spectacular. So I worked mostly with Jeff Goldblum and Laura. My scenes, doubling Laura. The action, I didn't get to work with Sam Neill, which I, too bad. Anyway, and Spielberg, it was an absolute thrill because he would direct from behind the camera. Again, not a megaphone. Well, maybe it was a megaphone. And he would say, okay, Pat. And then he'd yell, one, two, three. And those were my marks that I was to hit during the action. For example, we had a scene where the T-Rex is chasing the Jeep. And we crash through a branch, which takes off the windshield. We all had to duck at the right moment. And then the T-Rex catches up with the Jeep, hits the Jeep with the side of its head, and we escape, right? So somehow, thank God they had those short little arms. He could have just grabbed us and we'd it was really good. Yeah, they had short little arms. So for us, the T-Rex was a stick that's like, I don't know what, 15 feet tall, and it's metered off every couple, like 2 feet, maybe every 24 inches, black, white, black, white, black, white. It's painted black and white all the way up. And at the very top of the stick is a round cardboard circle that is stapled to the top of the stick. And someone had taken a Sharpie and made a happy face with teeth. That was our T-Rex. I mean, really, we had no idea how this was gonna look.
So terrifying.
It was very terrifying. Whatever. I'm more afraid of just driving through this branch right at this moment. Spielberg said, okay, Pat, so when I say one, you're looking over your right shoulder behind you at this level. And they put the stick with the happy face and teeth. And where that, okay, now my eye line is going to be at that. And number, when I yell two, your eye line is here, which is much more alarming. Now it's lower and way closer, right? So it's maybe 9 feet off the ground, something like that. So it's starting to run and level out. And then three is the side of the door has a reverse explosive mechanism in it where it's pulling the door in to look like the T-Rex has hit it with its head, but I have to move my legs because it's actually going to crunch into where my legs are. So I got to move my legs. At the same time, another explosive is going off in our Jeep that's taking a piece of an electrical pole. You know, those big round logs that you, the electrical pole, telephone poles.
Yeah.
So it's like a 4-foot section of that's been cut off, inserted into a cannon in the middle of our Jeep. And on three, it's going to explode down into the ground, which is going to rock our Jeep up. At the same time, this is getting smashed in. So our, the stunt guy who's the driver he's focused on keeping us from tipping over, and I'm focused on not getting crushed. So, and Danny Epper, who's doubling Jeff Goldblum, is just focusing on not falling out. So that's right. He's just going like this all over the place. And but the thrill was when they say action, so Spielberg's in the camera car that's riding off of our front right bumper. So he's in front of us, right off the front right bumper. And there we're supposed to be tooling along at the same speed. So the camera is always the same distance. And then we crash through the branch, the windshield goes. And then Spielberg goes, "Okay, Pat, one." And so I'm looking, and then he says, "Two," and then three. And that was, you know, I got directed by Steven Spielberg. And I didn't die.
Awesome. Yeah.
The second time that my biggest stunt was in the rotunda at the very end when the T-Rex and the Raptors crash into the building, into the rotunda area. And
you just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Heroes are climbing down from the ceiling on this really rickety scaffolding. Remember the heights thing again?
Yeah.
I'm at the top of this building and I have to climb down. And they purposely made the scaffolding go like this, you know, so it's swaying back and forth. And of course, I have to go the furthest. The kids stop pretty quickly. R.A. Rondell, who is doubling Sam, he gets to stop. But no, Laura is our heroine. She has to go all the way out across over the top of these a dinosaur spine, all the way on to its neck, and then falls, holds on to its neck, and then the whole thing falls apart and she hits the ground. But that was so hard to do, not only because it was so far off the ground, it really made me nervous, but I also, I had to balance on dinosaur bones, and they made a full-scale replica of this brontosaurus with the bones out of resin. I don't even want to know what that alone cost, you know, how they did that. And then it's suspended with wires that go out. So it's this big display, right? Just like in a museum, a full-size brontosaurus. I have to run along the spine of that thing. But not, I can't run just straight along the spine. No, they've got wires suspending it from the ceiling, of course. So I have to constantly stop and get around the wire without falling off or breaking my ankle because it's getting stuck in the vertebrae of this dinosaur. And I have to accomplish it in a certain time frame, too. I got to get all the way over there. And then I have to fall on my tummy. And then I have to flop around. It's But the night before, when we had practiced this, we rehearsed it over and over again. And I'm wearing pads, and we're all wearing long sleeves and padding underneath because we're getting dinged up. I got so badly bruised on those resin, hard, thin, you know, sort of really impacting my flesh. These bones that when I got home that night and I took off my sweatpants, I had bruises that looked like I'd broke, every bone had been broken in my body. It was so bad. And I did everything I could. I iced myself down. I was like, I went to the set an hour early. It was all, my call was already like 5 a.m. I went at 4 a.m. when the crew was getting there. And I said, I don't want to alarm you. I walked into the, I couldn't believe the special effects guys were already there. I went in there and I said, I don't want to alarm you, but you guys are going to need to get a body paint artist in here. And I dropped my pants and they were like, holy shit. I was solid black bruises. So they did, they called in a makeup artist and they sprayed me down and it, amazing. But I was really swollen from these bruises. And I also had tweaked my wrist. It was a really hard job. And it's so funny. So I finally, you know, I didn't sleep all night. I was so worried. I get there, they spray me down. By the time we're actually on the set, it's like, I don't know, 9 or 10 a.m. And Spielberg arrives and he calls, I'm talking to my stunt coordinator who's saying, like, are you okay? And I was actually in a bit of tears going, I'm not okay. I'm not 100%. I don't know how I'm going to do this. And Spielberg arrives. So we both go, you know, put the nice face on. Oh, we got this. And he says to Gary, okay, Gary Hymas was our stunt coordinator. I had this idea last night. And Gary's already twitching because Spielberg's like this. He just has amazing ideas, but he brings them in at the last minute. And it's impossible to change these massive stunts. They've taken months to plan and build, you know, to build out the mechanisms that are going to make this all work. And so he comes, he goes, I got this idea. I want to do this shot. So we're over Pat and she's on the bones. And just like at Home Alone, you know, when we follow the bad guys through and they break through them, we follow them all the way to the ground. Can we do that with Pat? Onto a marble floor, mind you, a marble floor. And I'm like 15 feet in the air, supposed to drop flat on my back onto a marble floor. And Gary's like, oh, yeah, yeah. And he's twitching. He's like, yeah, we could do that. Yeah. We will kill her, but we could do that. And to his credit, like, oh, no. I mean, I don't want to kill her. And I'm sitting, I'm right here, guys. I'm right here. Holy
oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
The special effects guys came in and took pictures of my bruises for reference. They said, we've never seen anything like this on a live body. So
my word.
The inside of my arms, my legs. Oh, it was bad. Bad.
Yeah. Suffering for your art.
Yeah. You then obviously you then went on to work on things like multiple episodes of Star Trek. You had the prominent role of Lita on B5 during the 90s. What was it like on the sets of both Star Trek and B5 at that time?
Yeah, I had such a unique perspective because I was working on Babylon 5 at the same time as we were working on Next Generation and then Deep Space Nine. And I don't think anybody else I know ever did that, go back and forth. I mean, there would be days I would be on Babylon 5 as Leo Alexander, and the next day I'd be doubling Terry Farrell on Deep Space Nine or Nana Visitor. And I never talked about it because I didn't want any producers on either show because it was a competitive situation. Yeah. I didn't want anyone to give me any shit and tell me I couldn't work because I never turned down a job. I would work all day, all night. It didn't matter to me. And yeah, so I was very quiet about it at the time. But so Paramount, being over at Paramount is cool. I mean, I've been on Next Generation for years and years and years. I had a membership at the gym on the Paramount lot. You know, I knew all the security guards. It was a very comfortable situation for me there. And then on Babylon 5, we were like the little engine that could, you know, we were this little bastard stepchild of Warner Brothers that nobody wanted to give any money to. So we were working out of a soundstage that they had built out of old warehouses in Sun Valley, which was an armpit of, you know, of the whole Los Angeles area. It's nasty up there in Sun Valley. Nobody else wanted to be there. Real estate's really cheap. So we ended up in the, let's see, was it the, it was an old hot tub plant or something like that at one time. So it was just a big soundstage they put that they created out of a warehouse that was falling down. And, but it was, you know, we were all in it together kind of thing. Yeah. And the producers were right there in the same building, you know, everybody ate together. We ate in the parking lot, for fuck's sake. We had even in the rain, we had like, you know, a tent set up. That was it, catering, you know. The dressing rooms for the actors were all the same. Bruce didn't have a really nice trailer and everyone else have a, you know, random trailer. Nope, we all had the same trailers. And you shared it. It was, so you go to Paramount and it's this big corporate machine and well overseen too. I mean, every little piece of Star Trek has gone over for quality control for as long and making sure it fits in with the, you know, the vibe fits in with the universe. There was a lot of tension because of that on some of the shows, like Voyager had a really rough start. And that was a very tense set. Next Generation was more friendly because they'd been together for a while. Mm. And then Deep Space Nine had the nicest vibe because the people were so sweet. They were overworked though. For the first couple years, they were overworked. In fact, crew members so exhausted, one of them died on the way home in an accident because he fell asleep at the wheel. And the Screen Actors Guild and the other unions changed the rules. They said, you can't work people 18 hours. You can't do that. They changed the rules on how long you could work a crew member. SAG already had those rules, Screen Actors Guild, but they started enforcing them and saying, you can't have these turnarounds constantly. You can do that once or twice a week, but you can't do that every day. You know, people were just falling over with exhaustion, but because they had a lot to live up to. Plus the suits, there was only one producer I saw on a more regular basis over there. The rest of them only showed up when there was a problem. I didn't want to see, you know. Yeah. So it was very different, a very different vibe entirely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I enjoyed both. I had a great time on both.
Oh, great. I mean, since then, you wrote your book, Pleasure Thresholds. How enjoyable was that experience? And do you have any particularly fond memories of the people you worked with at the time or since for that book?
The book was a great thing to do. I didn't want to do it. But I'm so glad I did because it gave me a chance. When I was working those days, I was working so hard. Plus, I had a toddler. A baby myself, I was a single mom. I never stopped. I didn't stop long enough to really take in the process of what I got to do. When I wrote the book, I got to go back through all my call sheets and all those memories and think about, oh my God, look at all the things I did. Look at all the things that happened. That was amazing. So the book was a joy on that front. I also had an amazing editor, Jason Davis, who also wrote a great book on the X-Files, if anyone's a fan of the X-Files. It was a really good experience and it made me some money, which has been so helpful. Really, really grateful for that. Yeah, and as far as my cast goes, we're still really close. We're the Babylon 5 actors are all really good friends. So you know, 30 years in, we're still really good friends. It's very nice.
It's nice to be able to see that as a B5 fan, to look back and see that you're all still friends so far after.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, it's cool. It's cool. Right. We stay in touch with each other and try to see each other. Like when Peter does get out to the West Coast, we all get together and have dinner or something like that. We make sure that we make a connection, make an effort to connect. Yeah.
Awesome.
you mentioned already you've worked obviously on Babylon 5, but also on Star Trek in the 90s. And as part of that, in terms of acting and stunt work, you did a lot of work in prosthetic makeup, some of which you've not been overly kind about, the sort of the Janai in the Outcast in particular, or the villain in Starship Mine. And I was just curious, what's your favorite and least favorite, if you have a favorite, of the sort of alien makeups that you had to wear?
Oh my God. So they have different aspects, you know. With Kiros in Starship Mine, I just thought I looked like Bozo with a vagina on my face. I mean, seriously. I
read that somewhere, yeah.
You look at it. No, you look at any close pictures and then you just look. There's vulva and clit right on my forehead. It's obvious. And they teased my hair out like Bozo the Clown. I was so bummed. Like, I finally get a character from beginning to end. I don't die till the end, you know? Yeah. And they did that to me. That annoyed the shit out of me. But I had I had one I hated the wig on, and that was for Deep Space Nine. I think it was M'Laura. The episode was called M'Laura. I doubled the actress playing M'Laura. She was lovely. And I had a good time, but the wig was so intense. The hairline, the pins they put into my head, and that wig was killing me. That was migraine city. The Klingon sisters, when I doubled B'Tor in Star Trek Generations, the film, that was a lot. It's not only was it, you know, the teeth and the forehead, but it was the skin makeup was pretty intense. And then, of course, the wig. On that's another one that was a lot. The costume we had was made of leather, so it didn't give at all. It was super confining. I found out I was pregnant while I was shooting that. And of course, when you're pregnant, your body changes a little bit while you're pregnant. And from the costume fitting to by the time we finished, I think I was like 5.5 months pregnant. And there's some significant body changes that happen at that point.
Yeah.
I was pretty miserable. but I didn't get, I did get to double Gates. I love that, doubling Gates in that British Navy uniform, which was my favorite costume, I think, ever, was that British Navy uniform. Awesome. That was so awesome. Oh, so good.
Yeah. Fantastic.
So I think the witch in Army of Darkness was the worst makeup ever. So that was by far the worst.
So not a Star Trek one then.
No, it wasn't a Star Trek one. No. She was a...
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Your son Julian's made an appearance alongside you in the 2009 short Waiting. Has he shown any inclination to follow in the acting footsteps of his mother?
No, but he's a musician. So he does have his own, what's the word? He has his own showmanship, you know, qualities going on. He's a musician, he's a drummer, a sound engineer, and he can sing, you know, so it's really up to him what he wants to do. He plays several instruments. So, no, he's not an actor, but he does love,
He does performing.
Yeah.
Oh, nice one.
You do a lot of work for the Penny Lane charity, specifically the Be a Santa campaign.
Yeah.
How did you become involved in that, and why does it mean so much to you personally?
I started working with Penny Lane in the 90s, and they had a yearly event that went on, and Dennis Mavillon, who was our stunt coordinator on Star Trek, mm-hmm. would do a demonstration for the kids. So I started becoming familiar with them, because I think I did that with them for like, you know, 3 or 4 years in a row. So I was really, I loved Penny Lane. I love the idea. Penny Lane works with the foster care system, getting the kids that are most hard to cope with because they've been so abused over either from their original families or through the process of being in the programs. Penny Lane's pretty groundbreaking in the systems they put into place to help these really hard to help kids. I was so in awe of what they were doing, and on a shoestring budget, right? Because we were doing this event, but the event didn't raise any money for the kids. And I thought, oh, well, we could do better than that. So I started the Be a Santa thing. I didn't know what else to call it. That was not the name I wanted, but the name just stuck. I couldn't think of anything better. So it's called Be a Santa. But basically what I was trying to do is to wrangle the sci-fi fans in community and horror fans to pitch in a few bucks and make a holiday happen for these kids. Especially the teenagers, because they're really, it's like everybody wants to adopt the kitten and the puppy, but nobody wants to adopt the older animals. That's a terrible analogy, but you know what I mean? Like babies when you're cute, and then you get a teenager and you're like, oh, fuck no, I don't want to take that on, right? Nobody wants a teenager. You don't even want your own teenagers, much less somebody else's teenager. So I thought we really need to show these kids that there's hope. That there's good people out there, that people do give a shit. And we've been doing it for almost 30 years now. Yeah, that's how I started doing that. Nice. It's been the fans. It's been the fans like yourself from all over the world, and everybody chips in a few bucks. And we start usually by October, and it's a small program because it doesn't need to be a big program. And it's just us. And usually there's like 120 people in the end who actually donate and make a whole holiday happen for these kids. And it has had impact. It is a good thing. It does make kids feel like, oh, you know, we make sure every kid gets a note with their name on it and all of it. So they really feel seen and appreciated, which is the whole point. The foster care system has money for them, and we free up funds for them too by taking care of the teenagers. They don't have to worry about the teens, and they can focus the money on the little kids. So it all works out. It works out really, really well. Yeah.
Does the campaign run all year round, or is it just around Christmas?
Yeah, you can donate anytime. You can donate anytime, but I don't really. I don't really do much until the holidays, because that's when people are ready to donate, I find.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Regular donors do something like on Facebook for their birthday, they'll raise money for Penny Lane or something like that. But most of the time, we just really focus at the end of the year.
Yeah. Because I was saying, we can always put the link in the description on the podcast so people can donate if they want to.
Okay. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Cool. I was going to say, since then, you've gone on to found Quest Retreats and Magical Living. We touched on it earlier. I've been a supporter of both projects for a while. I was actually gutted that I missed out on the Tolkien Middle Earth Quest Retreat. But for our audience, could you tell us a little about it and what you've got coming up with regards to that?
Thank you. Yeah. Speaking of, you know, all that, how fear can be pretty crushing, and what I've learned about fear, which is why I'm doing this, what I'm doing right now. Coming up, I have a webinar called How to Tame Your Fear Dragon. And the reason is because about 12 years ago, I had a nervous breakdown, or maybe you'd call it a psychotic break. Or then now I call it an awakening. So what happened was, you know, just the stress and the pressure over time, finally, it just like that, they call it the straw on the camel's back. Just the one little thing happened and I just completely bottomed out. I fell apart. I fell apart so thoroughly, though, that it was quite interesting. It really got my attention this time. Instead of just pushing through fear, I really had to restructure, rebuild, because I really was so decimated just emotionally by all the stuff I didn't look at over the decades. So that I had to look at the stuff. And what it really came down to for me was that I didn't understand the connection between fear and, let's see, and stress and anxiety, the toll that it takes, and how you can completely avoid that if you just know a few basic things.
Yeah.
It's not hard to understand if you really, but they don't teach this stuff in school, really. Now, maybe more now, but the idea that that fear is actually your friend. Fear is trying to tell you something, and you can work with fear if you know what's going on, because the body is going through a thing. I love affirmations and mantras and all those things. They're great. But if you're not dealing with the body's reaction, it's not going to work. No matter how many times you say something positive, it will not do what you want it to do if you're not working with your physiology. So the connection between the physiology and the psychology is so important. I have had some pushback on this from people who say, well, you just got to change your thought. You just have to look at things differently. Absolutely. But if you're not dealing with the amygdala and what's going on in your body, it's not going to have the effect you hope it is. So that's what I teach in these webinars. And then I started teaching different classes on how to build better habits into the life you want. Because what I see in our community is nerds, you know, we are so, we love these films and television shows, right? We love Star Trek. We love Star Wars. We love Lord of the Rings. These movies and these things, these speak to us on a really particular level. I think it's part of it is because this is how we're wired and how we learn, and also what keeps us inspired. But I decided I didn't want to just read about this shit anymore. I want to live it. I want to have a life that makes me feel like that. I want to have that adventure. I want to feel that engaged with life. I want to feel that wonderful. And I haven't been able to feel, because I've been pushing through so much fear and so protected. And I think a lot of us have that protective mechanism. I don't know about you, but I was made fun of a lot when I was a kid. I had red hair. I was a nerd and, you know, got shoved in lockers. You know, it's not an easy life being growing up a nerd, at least back in the day. Now it's, you know, we're all kind of embracing that. But so I also think that the other really important thing is when you're trying to focus your life into having the types of success you want in your life, whether it's in a relationship or whether it's in your job or whether it's in just, you know, living where you want to live or taking trips you want to take, you need to have some support around that. When you're alone with it and working towards anything all by yourself, your brain is going to mess with you, because your brain doesn't want you doing anything new, nothing new. Even if it means I need to lose weight, or my diabetes is going to get me. Well, your brain doesn't want you to change any habits. So how are you going to work with that so that you can actually get healthier when your actual brain is working against you? So we just think we're lazy or we're bad or we have bad habits, and we think it's us. It's not. It's our physiology, and that you can work with if you know the little tricks on that. But we're not taught that shit. I don't know why. So I teach it. And I've created a community that supports each other in that process called the Magical Living Community. Because it's not that I think these magical thoughts, you know, it's not that I'm waving one, but it feels magical when you actually are able to do this shit things all of a sudden start lining up. We're so used to things being hard and having to work hard, having to suffer, having to try a thing and just feel like a failure. We're so used to that, that when that starts to go away, when you actually just work with what's going on in your body, that it feels magical. You realize things just kind of start to flow in and you're like, how is this even possible? So then you need to recalibrate again, because it's like, I don't deserve this. How is this happening? I'm not dying or working really hard. It's just kind of, you have to start to recalibrate, like, yeah, this is normal and you do deserve it and it does work.
Yeah.
It's really an interesting process. But I find that just teaching one class, like I used to teach just a class at a time or whatever, but it's not enough time to create those new habits. It's not enough time to really start to trust your process, because you're going to run into these, you're going to run into closed doors, right? You're going to have that fear dragon show up in new ways. I call them faces of fear. You know, did you see Game of Thrones?
Yeah.
So, you know, the faceless men, the assassins, the faceless men.
Yeah.
Who can put on any face and be anybody anytime. Fear is that clever. Fear can look like hard work, busyness. It can look like perfectionism. It can look like practicality. And really what it is fear. But unless you know that and you know how to work with it, you think, oh my God, I'm just lazy. I just need to do. He got all these weird thoughts going on. So I wanted people to have a place to bring this in, to come in and say, I'm trying to do this thing and this keeps happening. What do I do? And then we can work together. Everybody works together.
Yeah.
So that's what's called magical living. Yeah. That's it.
Fantastic. And have you got anything, have you got any webinars coming up at the moment then? Or I think this comes out on the 12th. Is that right, Mike?
Yes. Yeah.
Is that where you're going? Yeah. Okay, yeah. Then I'll have a replay going out, and I'll give you links so you guys can post it.
Great. Yeah.
I'll have a replay for How to Tame Your Fear Dragon, and then we'll be pushing into, I've got a 50% discount for joining the community, so folks might be interested at that time too.
Definitely. I
appreciate it so much. And then the trips you were asking about, I do those. I try to do a trip like once a year. We just finished with Africa. We did a big one in Africa, and they're adventure retreats, for folks like us who want to do something really extraordinary, but it takes a lot for me to plan one. As you know, that 2019 was, the Lord of the Rings trip. That was amazing. And I'll let you know when the next one, I'm not sure. I'm looking into a couple things right now to see what I want to do.
Fantastic. I mean, I'm conscious that we're kind of running over a bit, but we've had that many questions and we've had to leave that many out because there's just so you're welcome back anytime if you want to come back.
Oh, thank you.
But I'll let Mike, if Mike's got any last questions.
I just wanted to say thank you again for chatting to us. Honestly, it's been a joy. You've been just a pleasure to listen to, and I could talk for hours and go for another hour just talking about Star Trek personally. But we'll not keep you any longer. Just one last question was, obviously, you've had probably the most interesting and varied career of anybody we're going to ever talk to over the years. And what's next for you? Is there anything coming up?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, we're in last year in April, I sold my house. I got married to my college sweetheart here, and we've just hit the road. So we've been traveling. And right now we're in South Africa. Next time I talk to you, I don't know where I'll be. And we're just kind of living wherever we go. Until we don't want to do that anymore. I don't know. I don't really know where I want to settle. I needed to get out of the United States and just have a different experience. So, that's what I'm doing now. I'm looking forward to filling you in on what's next. Next time we talk, we'll see what's going on.
Awesome. That's fantastic. Well, I look forward to speaking to you again sometime, hopefully then. And we'll let you go now, because as I say, we've kept you for way longer than we should have probably. But thank you so much again.
Thank you for giving us your time. It's been an absolute
pleasure.
Okay.
Take care, guys.
Take care.
You too. Bye. And there you have it, fellow nerds. I hope you're as glad as we were to find out that Pat's just as big a nerd as we are. So there were so many questions that we couldn't ask, but we were pressed for time. So, but hopefully, you know, if the stars align, Pat will be back with us. She seemed quite eager. Hopefully she's enjoyed it. So again, a thank you to you, Pat, and thank you to your assistant Avery for setting that up. So yeah, hopefully you've enjoyed this special bonus interview episode of the Hit or Miss podcast. So what's coming up next, Mike, with regards to the show?
Well, we still are on something of a hiatus for the Hit or Miss Star Trek podcast, but do keep an eye on the channel because sometimes you might see things like this popping up or bits and pieces. We will have an upcoming episode, a top 10 episode, which I'm not revealing what it's the top 10 of yet, but it is going to be coming up very soon. And we will obviously get to eventually later in the year a full series talking about Klingon episodes, which I've mentioned before. As far as the Silver Screen podcast goes, we are in the middle of our third series. We've had a few sort of issues with regards to people that we thought were going to be able to join us and help out. So we've had to make it a fortnightly series instead of weekly releases. We are still carrying on with that. So yeah, we're hoping that we can at least stick to that fortnightly release, and we should do. Time of watching, I believe our Scream 2022 review or Scream 5 review will be out. We will be about to release a review of John Wick, and we've got upcoming releases for Prometheus and I forget what else, but we definitely have another top 10 coming up there as well.
Bond movies. We've got a top 10 Bond movies coming up.
Top 10 James Bond films. So if you are a 007 fan, you're definitely going to want to stay tuned for that one as well. So, yeah.
And if you're a John Wick fan, tune in, because neither myself nor Mike has seen it. So,
and we are joined though, just to fill out a little bit of the context there, by Superfan Sandra Henderson, who you'll have heard before, who insisted on us doing the John Wick films and was kind of good. We aren't doing all three, but so, yeah, she's the super nerd that's going to talk us through this franchise, and we'll be popping our John Wick cherries. So, yeah.
Ooh.
So yeah, all that remains then is to say thank you again so much to Patricia. We honestly could have talked to you for hours. It's been such a crazy varied career. We know you will know her from a thousand places, and hopefully you've enjoyed the interview. Stay tuned on both of our channels. We'll be back soon, but in the meantime, remember,
I'll be back.
You have been listening to the Silver Screen Podcast, hosted by Michael Wilson and DK, created, produced, and edited by Michael Wilson. Behind the scenes sections and additional material produced by DK. Music by Timeless Journey. More information can be found at soundcloud.com/timelessjourney. Follow the podcast on Instagram at Silver Screen Podcast, or look for the Silver Screen Podcast under Facebook groups. Links to all our social media accounts and more are in this episode's description. This podcast is available on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. Just look for Silver Screen, Hit or Miss Star Trek. This has been a Mike's Podcast production, copyright 2022. Thank you for listening.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.